Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This morning, the United States Senate just voted to make political history. It's the first significant social policy in 20 years, the first real health reform in nearly 50.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
President Barack Obama's health reform passed the Senate today with only one more round of talks with the House left before it becomes law. But it's not the last we'll be hearing of health reform.
Republicans will run against it in 2010 and 2012, and they'll win back the House and the Senate and the presidency so that by 2012, they'll have enough power to get rid of it altogether.
We've got the policy, we've got the politics, and the prognostications. Health reform shapes 2008, 2010, and beyond on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 24th, this Christmas Eve. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry, and I'm here with Celeste.
Good morning, Todd. 60 eyes have it, but I don't think anybody has what they really wanted, right? This is a compromise that doesn't have anyone completely happy.
That's absolutely right.
Let's get to the top stories. The U.S. Senate has passed a landmark health care bill. 58 Democrats and two independents voted in favor, with 39 Republicans voting against the bill. Capped off months of negotiations and over 3 weeks of floor debate, Senator Chris Dodd, one of the four leading Democrats on the bill, spoke just minutes ago.
There's never been a vote cast in my tenure here that's done as much to relieve the burdens or provide more security for middle-class working families in America than this one.
Earlier, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Republicans will continue to fight the bill.
I want to assure you, Mr. President, this fight isn't over. In fact, this fight is long from over.
There's one more step left before that bill becomes law and President Obama can sign it. It has to be reconciled with the House version, and that's not a small task. The House version has a public option in it. The Senate bill does not.
As Senator Mitch McConnell says, this fight is long from over. Mary Agnes Carey joins us now. Mary Agnes is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's in the Senate, just steps from the Senate floor. Mary Agnes, what's the mood right now around there? Have the senators dashed for the exits?
They absolutely dashed for the exits, but it was a very jubilant mood, very exciting mood. Members were congratulating each other on the floor and off the floor. Vicky Kennedy, Ted Kennedy's widow, was here and talked about the moment where Senator Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, said, "His vote, this is for my friend, Ted Kennedy, I," and she said that brought tears to her eyes. It was a very moving day. I think there is, on both sides of the aisle, there is an acknowledgement of the significance of today. A good year and a half in the making of this particular effort on health care reform has come to a vote in the Senate. But as you mentioned earlier, it's not the end. We're going to have to resolve differences between the House and the Senate. That package would have to be approved by both chambers before it can reach the president. And as you noted in your intro, Senator McConnell, minority leader, has said we're going to fight this thing every step of the way.
All right. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Thanks for joining us. We're going to continue the conversation on health care in just a few minutes.
An airstrike this morning in Yemen may have killed the radical Muslim cleric linked to the Fort Hood shooter. A Yemeni official tells Reuters the man is believed to be among 30 militants killed. The dream of a white Christmas is something of a nightmare for holiday travelers in the Midwest. Up to 2 feet of snow is forecast today, with a storm also dumping sleet and heavy rains. More than 100 flights out of Minneapolis have already been canceled.
Looking at the markets now, Asian stocks finished higher while European indices are up. Wall Street futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway this morning at 10,466. The S&P opens at 1,120. The NASDAQ opens at 2,269.
Coming up, we are remixing the holidays as we have been doing all week, and we're asking you, sing for us a little bit. Tell us, what is your guilty pleasure holiday song? And if you've ever been frustrated by rising cable bills, we have a solution for you, although it does take a little bit of working around your home. You can get your TV from the internet. We are, of course, going to be following the health care reform bill. It has passed this morning, but we're going to be talking about what that means and what the final bill will look like once it gets reconciled with the House version.
Good morning. This is Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry. I'm here with Celeste. A historic vote in the Senate has just come to an end.
Mrs. Boxer, I Mr. Brown.
Aye.
Mr. Brown.
Aye.
Here's Harry Reid now, the Senate Majority Leader.
Mr. Brown back.
Progress and opportunity are what this historic bill represents. To those who so admirably care so much for their fellow man that they demand more, I say, this is just the beginning. With Senator Ted Kennedy's voice booming in our ears, with his passion in our hearts, we say, as he said, the work goes on, the cause endures.
The 60-39 vote on this morning's cold Christmas Eve morning capped months of negotiation and 24 days of floor debate. Sometimes it seemed like it went on for 24 hours a day. It also followed a succession of failures by past Congresses to get to this point. Vice President Joe Biden presided as 58 Democrats and two independents voted yes. Republicans unanimously voted no. We want to get some scene from the floor and from off the Senate floor now. And joining us to do it, John Stanton, Senate reporter for Roll Call newspaper on Capitol Hill. And we're rejoined by Mary Agnes Carey. Mary Agnes is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's in the Senate as well. John Stanton, I imagine you had some time to spend in the Senate chamber during the vote. What did you see?
Well, we saw a couple of interesting things, I think. One, most notably on the Republican side, is the fact that Senator Jim Bunning from Kentucky, who's retiring and I guess increasingly checking out, did not show up for the vote. He also did not show up for votes yesterday. Bernie Sanders, also an independent from Vermont, was the last vote for passage of the bill. He sort of came running in at the end of the vote and sat down and voted aye to applause from his colleagues.
Voted aye. Was Sanders in some ways, his vote wasn't needed on this because you only need 51, so was Sanders kind of bucking to be a holdout here?
No, I think he just overslept.
he just overslept. All right, Mary Agnes, this is the kind of vote, you know, senators say they work their whole careers to pass. Just political rhetoric, or do you think there are some members of the body who really feel like this is a career accomplishment?
Oh, I absolutely do. I mean, look at some of the key lieutenants to Harry Reid, the majority leader on this, Chris Dodd, Tom Harkin, Max Baucus. These are folks, Dick Durbin from Illinois, long legislative histories, and Senator Durbin, who's the assistant majority leader, said at the microphones just a few minutes ago that this is, you know, one of the most significant votes in a member's tenure. Chris Dodd said the same thing. I think they completely will look at this as one of the pinnacles of their legislative careers.
Now, Mary Agnes, Senator Mitch McConnell said, we heard him before say, this debate is far from over. It sounded almost
right,
like a threat, and I want to ask you the policy question, and John, I'll ask you sort of the politics question of that threat. Mary Agnes, the minority leader, says this is far from over. It may have more to go, but can Republicans do much now to derail this process?
Well, I think that they will continue to talk, especially now. We're heading up on a Christmas break, holiday break for the Senate and the House, a three-week period, if not longer for members, depending on which chamber comes in. So I think that Republicans will continue to hammer away at this bill, at all the things they don't like. They don't like the Medicare cuts. They feel that it's too much government intrusion into your lives. They feel that it will not reduce health care costs. So that message will continue over the break, and it will continue when they return. And we will have a period, it's undetermined at this point, of House and Senate conference negotiations. And throughout those talks, Republicans will continue to hammer away at the bill. So their message of this bill will be bad for America is going to continue. And I think that's what they're talking about. And then when it comes time to get to a conference report, they will use every procedural tactic, as they have during this debate, to delay that. So I think that you'll see a repeat, if you will, of what we've had the last 25 days on the floor will certainly come to pass when a conference report is produced.
John Stanton from Roll Call, I want to turn that question around on you, because the strategy from Republicans so far seems to have been make this process take as long as possible, and in the meantime, really try to do your best to turn the public against the bill. That strategy continue, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, they frankly have done, I think, a very, very good job of turning the public against the bill. I mean, the public, when you ask in polling, you look at, you know, when you ask people what they know about the bill, a lot of what they say they know is not necessarily what's in the bill, but it's what Republicans have been saying is in the bill, and what the Republicans have been saying the bill will do. I think you're going to definitely see that continue. I think the one problem Republicans are going to have is that at this point, it looks like in the conference committee, they have about $30 billion difference between the House and Senate bills. bill and sort of the $900 billion cost that President Obama has put on as the outside limit on this thing. That money is going to be used to just frankly buy off votes in the House, it looks like. They're going to try to like give as many sweeteners as they possibly can to get enough votes in the House to make sure they can get it through the House, keeping the bill sort of as close to the Senate version as they possibly can to keep their 60 votes over here.
Now, you say buy off, just so that people know, that's not necessarily writing a check to a senator's campaign fund, but it's maybe giving something for a congressman's state. Here's some money for some hospitals in your district. Here's some Medicaid money.
Well, exactly. And you know, people sort of, it's become a sort of maligned kind of operation, but really it's the classic part of legislating. I mean, it's always been done since the beginning of time, certainly in this country, but in pretty much any legislative body, that there, when a member is uncomfortable with a bill or is having problems with a bill, they will often be given sweeteners or some money or some, you know, provisions in that bill or another bill to help bring them along. So it's a fairly common practice.
$100 million for Medicaid in Nebraska or $300 million for Louisiana. So-called around the Senate to Louisiana purchase, something
the
like
pork,
that.
The pork, this is what we refer to as the bacon.
It's a little different from pork, but effectively, Celeste, you're exactly right. It winds up being almost the exact same thing. Mary Agnes, let me ask you, you know, we're talking with you and with John Staton a little bit about the Republican strategy of turning the public against this bill. A lot of the big provisions don't take effect for years, and there's an election coming up. Is there enough in this bill that Democrats can turn it around and justify its passage by the next election? It's not all spending. It's not all pork. There's something in it for you right now.
They'll talk about, for example, that you are going to get help with pre-existing medical conditions for kids. That kicks in the next 6 months. Reinsurance pools for people that can't get insurance. Those would kick in immediately. Then again, some annual, lifetime limits would kick in. They're going to go to provisions that would go into effect immediately and say, this will help you now, and the rest of the bill will help you later.
And there's a provision in there that if you're, at least in the Senate version, if your kids are 26 or between 18 and 26,
right.
they can stay on your insurance.
They can stay on your insurance. That's exactly what they'll do. They'll go through what can go into effect immediately and use that as a bridge, if you will, to full implementation, which is, for the Senate bill isn't until 2014. So that could cause a bit of a political problem in the midterm elections and the presidential election. House bill, a lot of these provisions kick in 2013. So in conference, they might try to move those start dates up.
Move those up. And Democrats have a lot of motivation for moving them up because there's an election much, much sooner than that. And you don't want it to be all about $1 trillion out the window. You want people to think they've gotten something out of it. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's in the Senate right now. So is John Staton, Senate reporter for Roll Call. Hey, thanks a lot, you both, for joining us. We appreciate it. And now here's a look at some of the stories we're following this morning.
As we've been talking about, in the past hour, the U.S. Senate passed a landmark health care bill. It passed by 60 to 39 votes. That's 58 Democrats and 2 independents against 39 Republican votes. One of the leading Democrats in the Senate, Chris Dodd, spoke in the past half hour.
This was an enormous victory for the American public, and I'm proud to have been one vote was cast in favor of this effort.
The bill extends insurance to nearly 30 million Americans who don't have it and stops insurance companies from denying benefits because of pre-existing conditions. In other news, Mexican authorities have arrested 4 suspects in the murder of a Marine's family. The Marine was involved in a gun battle with a drug lord. 4 of his family members were later gunned down in their home in what appeared to be a revenge killing.
Here in the U.S., around 100 flights have been canceled at Minneapolis Airport. Much of the nation's midsection will have a white Christmas, but plenty of travel headaches as well. Blizzard warnings are up for parts of Kansas and North Dakota. Later today, regulators are expected to disclose that top executives of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac each earned between $4 and $6 million this year. Meanwhile, stock futures are pointing to a modestly higher opening today. New reports on unemployment and durable good orders are expected to show the economy is continuing its recovery. Overseas, markets are also higher this morning. The U.S. markets will close early for the Christmas holidays. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Coming up, Midnight Mass at 10 p.m.
It's not Midnight Mass, is it?
No, it can't be Midnight Mass if it's at 10, and it's 10 p.m. Mass.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week. The Pope is going to break tradition by holding the Midnight Mass 2 hours earlier at 10 p.m. rather than midnight. And actually, it's kind of a common joke among Catholics to ask, when's the Midnight Mass? Because churches do hold it as early as like 7 p.m. People don't have to hold it. The definition that you have to hold midnight mass at midnight or sometime before in order to be a true Eucharist. We're joined right now from Rome, David Willey, the BBC's correspondent there. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
As I said, many churches do hold the midnight mass, the Eucharist, earlier than midnight, but the Pope doesn't usually.
Not usually, although the late Pope, John Paul II, did so when he was getting old and tired and ill. And he sometimes celebrated midnight mass at 10 o'clock. The midnight mass, of course, will extend until midnight because it's a long service. There has been a lot of speculation here in Rome that bringing forward the mass by 2 hours meant that the Pope is packed, in fact, may not be very well. But I don't subscribe to that theory. I mean, he is getting old. He's going to celebrate his 83rd birthday next year. And he does have a heart condition, but I don't think there are any immediate fears for his health at the moment.
Well, and this particular time of year is a pretty busy one for the Pope.
Well, yes, he has a lot of responsibilities, a lot of services to attend. And, of course, after midnight, he'll have a few hours in bed, and then he'll be up again to celebrate the Mass during the morning, and most important of all, to give his special Christmas blessing, Urbi et Orbi, from the balcony of St. Peter's at midday, which is televised and transmitted by radio all over the world.
Has the Vatican given us a reason for why the Mass has been moved to 10 p.m.?
They just said that in view of the Pope's health considerations, it was considered wiser. I mean, I think it's a very good idea. I think a lot of Romans will be very happy. It's a terrible weather here in Rome, and it looks as though it'll be raining at midnight. So I think everybody will be happy to who wants to go to the Mass to get it over with and go back to bed and spend the rest of the night in
there. Really, all these Catholics who very much cherish their long held traditions, even especially in Rome where they're used to going out at midnight, there won't be anyone upset?
No, I don't think I've heard no complaints at all. I think that many families, particularly if they want to take their children, will be rather happy that it's not going on till 2 or 3 in the morning.
These would be families who have kids who are going to wake up as early as they possibly can to get to the gifts, right?
That's right. That's right. Except that here in Italy, of course, the gifts sometimes given at the celebrations are different.
We
have it on Christmas Eve, and then of course there's the Befana, the Epiphany, after Christmas, when traditionally this is celebrating the gift of the kings to the Christ, where children in Italy have in the past used to receive presents then as well. It less today. I think the commercial Christmas, that as it's celebrated in America and now in many countries of the world, much more commercialized than it used to be, the children see all the advertising and they want their presents now.
Okay, David Willey is the Vatican correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Some parents in Italy getting a little extra rest. The midnight mass, the Eucharist, will be at 10 p.m. tonight.
For our last take at now, we turn the mic over to you. Early this week, we talked about people who whitened their resumes to boost their chances of getting a job. One of our guests told us she even changed her name so she wouldn't face discrimination. Carolyn called us from Boston at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Italians did the same. Did they have to whiten their names? Jews did the same in the past. Did they whiten their names?
Actually, Jews and Italians and all kinds of immigrants to the United States have changed their names in order to fit in better. Caroline King also weighed in about that name change in this very topic. She emailed us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. She says, "This is nothing new. My mother is Czech. Her name was Maria Teresa Francisca Odlozel. When she became a nurse, she changed her name to Mary Odell." Probably easier to fit on a checkbook also. That was during the late 1930s. Turning now to the holiday season, what's Christmas Eve without a little caroling? All week we've asked you to sing us your favorite holiday song.
Hey, Paul Dubois. I'm calling from Cahunksen, New York. This is my favorite Christmas song. Santa's roasting on an open fire. Elves are boiling in a stew. In the air, everywhere, shoppers pulling their hair. Merry Christmas to you.
Okay, thanks, Paul. Todd, here's one of your favorites.
Hi, my name is Jeannie, and this is the Christmas favorite song that I'd like to sing. Rum bum 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 rum bum 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 rum bum 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 bum
Actually, I like that song as sung by Bing Crosby and David Bowie. I think my new favorite might be Elves Boiling in a Stew, actually. It might be my new favorite. But Mel called us, gave us a little spoken word.
My name is Mel Coles. My favorite song at Christmas is Vince Vance and the Valiants. All I Want for Christmas is You. And you are the angel atop my tree. You're my dream come true. Santa can't bring me what I need. 'Cause all I want for Christmas is you.
We've heard this one a few times. Seems to be one of our listeners' favorites.
Happy holidays. This is Susan, and I'm calling from Wakefield, Mass. And my favorite holiday song is the Eartha Kitt version of Santa Baby. Santa Baby, a 54 convertible to light blue. I'll wait up for you, dear Santa Baby. So hurry down the chimney tonight.
Susan, very nice. She just might win the prize for nicest voice there. Everyone, though, is getting points for singing and even the spoken word that we got. Thanks so much for calling in. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org and do a little singing for us like Eartha Kitt.
Next year I could be just as good if you check off my Christmas list. Santa baby, I
want. Coming up, an exclusive from the New York Times. How has Goldman Sachs managed to make profits and stay afloat while its investors have lost millions and millions? Louise Story has an answer, and she broke the news. We're going to talk to her in a few minutes. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A little over an hour ago, the U.S. Senate passed their landmark health care bill. 60 senators voted in favor, 39 Republicans voting against the bill. It capped off months of negotiations and over 3 weeks of floor debate. Senator Charles Schumer of New York speaking minutes ago from inside the Capitol building.
It cuts costs, the waste, the fraud, the duplication, and at the same time, it covers 31 million people. Who would have thought we could do both in the same bill?
Senator Chris Dodd, one of the four leading Democrats on the bill, said the long fight was worth it.
Last year, of course, proved that progress is not easy, but today we're able to prove that it's not impossible.
There's still one more round of negotiations with the House before the bill can become law, but President Obama told NPR yesterday the differences are fewer than he expected.
It's actually the remarkable similarities. 95% of the House bill and the Senate bill are in accord. And there are going to be some tough negotiations around the 5%.
Included in that 5%, the public option and how they're going to pay for all this. The House has a public option, the Senate does not.
Now, no Republicans are expected to support this bill at any part, any stage along the process. President Obama is expected to give his reaction in the next 15 minutes. We'll bring that to you live when it happens. Let's take a look at the markets now. Asian stocks finished higher while European indices are up. Wall Street futures are up as well. The Dow gets underway at 10,466. The S&P opens at 1120. The NASDAQ opens at 2269. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Do you feel like you understand why the housing market crashed? I kind of feel like I do, and yet I read the story in today's New York Times. Gretchen Morgenson and Louise Story have breaking news about three previously unknown investigations into who's to blame for the financial crisis, and specifically more about how some banks did what may have sped this crash along, if not been part of the cause. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning.
Okay, this is complicated. I read the whole article, and I feel like I understand it, but bear with me if I ask for a clarification on the way. This has to do with something that's called a CDO, which is a collateralized debt obligation. What does that mean?
So let's break it down into a few parts. First, these CDOs were bundles of mortgage risk. And so this, when you hear about Wall Street's, you know, fancy slicing and dicing of risk, they bundled mortgages into mortgage bonds and bundled those into CDOs. Now, this article we wrote is a very specific kind of CDO. It's called a synthetic CDO. And a synthetic CDO was a way that the banks hedged their risk. So remember, all these banks held on to a lot of their mortgages and mortgage bonds they created. So they had some mortgage risk. These synthetic CDOs, instead of including actual mortgage bonds, included insurance on mortgage risk. So it's kind of like you're afraid your house might burn down.
Right.
So Goldman knows the housing market might burn down. So you get insurance on your house. They get insurance on these mortgage risks that they have. And they package it into a bundle called a synthetic CDO, and they sold shares in this insurance for themselves to investors. And they marketed it as a good investment. When the housing market collapsed, this insurance paid them out, and it paid them out billions and billions and really helped Goldman and some others survive this crisis while other investment banks failed.
Now, one of the things that kind of, I mean, first of all, let's ask, is this what caused the financial crisis? Is this a cause of it?
There are a lot of causes, but this certainly poured fuel onto the fire. Because what this did is, as the banks protected themselves, it created billions and billions, hundreds of billions of additional dollars of exposure to this risky stuff.
I got to tell you, Louise, when I was reading your story, it kind of sounded like someone who took out an insurance policy on someone with themselves as the beneficiary and then murdered them, kind of. They're like collecting on an insurance policy before they killed the person.
That's the question. And these investigations that we've reported on by the SEC and FINRA and Congress, they will be looking at this question of intent. They will be looking at how purposefully did these banks design things that were designed to fail? Was that on purpose? Or is it more coincidental and they were just trying to protect themselves? And that's a real big question in this investigation.
Well, someone that you quoted in your story, Sylvan Rains, may be able to answer that big question. He's a structured finance consultant with R&R Consulting Firm. It's based in New York. Good morning, Sylvan.
Good morning, Celeste.
Can you answer this question that Louise just asked? Was this premeditated? Did Goldman look out for their clients or for themselves?
Well, you know, it's like I have good news and I have bad news. The good news would be that it would be unpremeditated, and the bad news would also be that it would be unpremeditated. I certainly hope that people in Wall Street know what they're doing. So I think that clearly there was an intent to do exactly what was done. Now, a synthetic CDO is just an extension of a normal cash flow, so-called cash flow CDO, but it's a further abstraction from reality. And what Louise is saying, essentially, is that in the synthetic market, there was no need or requirement for a direct connection between the exposures that you had and the deals and transactions that you underwrote. So you could buy insurance on your life, on the life of your neighbors, on the life of your enemies, your friends, anybody in the world, and there was no limit. You know, if you take the analogy of life insurance, you can only buy insurance on your life, and the number of people living in the United States is the theoretical limit to the amount of life insurance that can exist. But if you remove that boundary, then you could have life insurance on trillions of people, but you know that there's a problem there.
People don't exist. Well, did the pension funds that bought these things, did the investors that bought these things, did they know what was in them?
I would like to say that the investors were innocent, but I can't say that because they simply refused to look objectively. They simply said, okay, is this a rated transaction? Is there a rating by Moody's? If the answer is yes, I'm in. If the answer is no, I'm not in. And that's sort of, you know, going on the road and asking if there are any cops around. And if there are no cops, then you can go 100 miles an hour. I think this is irresponsible on the part of investors and Wall Street, of course.
Okay, so that's Sylvan Rains. He is a finance consultant with R&R Consulting Firm in New York. But Louise, these problems with CDOs, have we ended them? I mean, is this still out there that banks can create these synthetic CDOs and recreate this entire problem?
So they're not creating these now, okay, because there's a lot of scrutiny on these, but we're still living.
But they can.
They can, and they're creating some other kinds of things, but we're still living with the fallout from this. So one thing that's interesting is that the banks that went short through these, such as Goldman or such as Deutsche Bank or such as hedge funds like Tricadia, they are still benefiting today. They benefit for years afterwards because It takes quite a while until the CDO gets into so much trouble that it then pays those people who bought the insurance. So even though Goldman or Deutsche Bank might have taken some losses a couple years ago on mortgages, the profits they're making for years to come from these are really big. And I think that we all should watch next year if these investigations get deeper. The investigations are only getting going now because at first the government was trying to stabilize the system. But now there's a lot of regulators looking at who did what. What was the intent? Did they know what they were doing? And did they protect themselves over others?
Well, they definitely were protected while their investors lost millions. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Check out her exclusive breaking news story in today's paper. Coming up, President Obama heads to the state dining room to speak about the Senate health care bill that passed this morning. We will cover his speech as it happens. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. Today marks 30 years since the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. The invasion was ordered by then-Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. Today's anniversary resonates not just with Russians and other members of the former Soviet Union, but also with Americans after the recent announcement that President Obama will send 30,000 extra troops to Afghanistan, bringing the total to 100,000 now. Our friends at the BBC Russian service are covering the anniversary of the Soviet invasion today to remind us of the events of 30 years ago and to talk a little bit about the context for today. Kira Fomenko from the BBC Russian service joins us now from London. Kira, we want to look at history, why the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And just for a little bit of context, let's listen to the president at the time, Jimmy Carter.
Soviet efforts to justify this action on the basis of the United Nations Charter are a perversion of the United Nations that should be rejected immediately by all its members.
Soviet efforts to justify the invasion, what were they?
Actually, people in Russia remember these words by Jimmy Carter and remember the sanctions which followed, actually, America's refusal to come for the Olympics in 1980. But then in 1978 or even before that, the USSR has secretly funded and supported the Marxist Party of the day in Afghanistan. It was the People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, which came to power in 1978 after a military coup d'etat. There was no evidence that Soviet Union helped to organize this, but immediately started to send weapons and military advisors to Kabul to help and support this Marxist regime. And then it was a deep story of rivalry between different factions of the party, killing of the leader Taraki, leader of different faction Hafizullah Amin, took the place. Brezhnev was extremely angered by this, and he wanted to install more pro-Soviet leader, more pro-Soviet president of Afghanistan, Babrak Karmal. So he sent forces to Afghanistan, and the attack of the palace actually happened on the 27th of December 1979. It was a bloody attack and the bloody events which followed after that.
So, Kira Fomenko, you're describing a Soviet leader who wanted to basically install another Soviet satellite. But what about today? You know, when you talk to Russians, maybe in a bar or in a restaurant, now the United States is in Afghanistan. What do Russians think about our involvement there now? Do they think history's repeated itself?
Yes, it's a sense of deja vu among Russian people now, especially when a NATO operation started in Afghanistan. There are some similarities, of course, in this campaign, and Russian people recognize this. But the big difference is that perhaps the NATO operation could finish in success, while the Soviet operation in 1979 was actually meant to be a failure. And even among high-ranking officials, there was a feeling that it was unknown and unnecessary war.
You're saying that Russians have a sense of optimism that the U.S. effort could be a success there?
There is some optimism because it's a war on terror and it basically has a future and it has much more support around the world than the Soviet operation.
All right, Kira Fomenko, editor of the BBC Russian service. Today is the 30th anniversary of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev ordering troops into that country 30 years ago today. Essentially then, according to Kira, to install another Soviet satellite today. It's the war on terror. The United States is in Afghanistan to the tune of 100,000 U.S. troops. Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry this morning here with Celeste Headlee. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. We're just waiting to hear from President Obama. He's due to give a speech reacting to the news this morning that the Senate has, as expected, passed its version of a health care overhaul bill. We've been talking about it all morning. The bill would extend insurance to around 30 million Americans, but still needs to be reconciled with a different House version before it can be signed into law by the president sometime in 2020. This morning's voting was along party lines, all 39 Republicans voting against it. Actually, there are 40 Republicans in the Senate. One Republican missed the vote. Speaking on the House floor, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell said the bill does not cut costs.
The one test for any bill was whether it would lower cost. This bill fails that test.
Let's go live now to the president speaking from the White House.
Insurance reform package. Legislation that brings us toward the end of a nearly century-long struggle to reform America's health care system. Ever since Teddy Roosevelt first called for reform in 1912, seven presidents, Democrats and Republicans alike, have taken up the cause of reform. Time and time again, such efforts have been blocked by special interest lobbyists who've perpetuated a status quo that works better for the insurance industry than it does for the American people. But with passage of reform bills in both the House and the Senate, we are now finally poised to deliver on the promise of real, meaningful health insurance reform that will bring additional security and stability to the American people. The reform bill that passed the Senate this morning, like the House bill, includes the toughest measures ever taken to hold the insurance industry accountable. Insurance companies will no longer be able to deny you coverage on the basis of a pre-existing condition. They will no longer be able to drop your coverage when you get sick. No longer will you have to pay unlimited amounts out of your own pocket for the treatments you need. And you'll be able to appeal unfair decisions by insurance companies to an independent party. If this legislation becomes law, workers won't have to worry about losing coverage if they lose or change jobs. Families will save on their premiums. Businesses that would see their costs rise if we do not act will save money now, and they will save money in the future. This bill will strengthen Medicare and extend the life of the program. It will make coverage affordable for over 30 million Americans who do not have it. 30 million Americans. And because it is paid for and curbs the waste and inefficiency in our health care system, this bill will help reduce our deficit by as much as $1.3 trillion in the coming decades, making it the largest deficit reduction plan in over a decade. As I've said before, these are not small reforms, these are big reforms. If passed, this will be the most important piece of social legislation since the Social Security Act passed in the 1930s, and the most important reform of our health care system since Medicare passed in the 1960s. What makes it so important is not just its cost savings or its deficit reductions. It's the impact reform will have on Americans who no longer have to go without a checkup or prescriptions that they need because they can't afford them, on families who no longer have to worry that a single illness will send them into financial ruin, and on businesses that will no longer face exorbitant insurance rates that hamper their competitiveness. It's the difference reform will make in the lives of the American people. I want to commend Senator Harry Reid, extraordinary work that he did, Speaker Pelosi for her extraordinary leadership and dedication. Having passed reform bills in both the House and the Senate, we now have to take up the last and most important step and reach an agreement on a final reform bill that I can sign into law. And I look forward to working with members of Congress in both chambers over the coming weeks to do exactly that. With today's vote, we are now incredibly close to making health insurance reform a reality in this country. Our challenge then is to finish the job. We can't doom another generation of Americans to soaring costs and eroding coverage and exploding deficits. Instead, we need to do what we were sent here to do and improve the lives of the people we serve. For the sake of our citizens, our economy, and our future, let's make 2010 the year we finally reform health care in the United States of America. Everybody, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year.
You have a holiday wish for
you're listening to the president. President Obama speaking from the White House on the health care bill that the Senate has just passed this morning. The bill's not finished yet. They still have to go into conference with the House, as the president mentioned. But the broad outlines of this policy and many of the fine points seem to be settled. The president going over them one by one, trying to remind Americans what they get out of this bill. The president said insurance companies will no longer be able to drop your coverage when you get sick. He said it'll strengthen Medicare and extend the life of the program. There are plenty of Republicans who disagree strongly with that statement. The president said the bill extends coverage to over 30 million Americans who don't have it now, and he also called these big reforms. He said that this bill, if it's passed, will be the most significant, most important piece of social legislation since the Social Security Act passed in the 30s and since Medicare passed in the 60s under the leadership of Lyndon Johnson. The president also said that our challenge is to finish the job, and he's talking about now about a conference with the House of Representatives and some continuing work that needs to be done on this bill. For a little bit of reaction and some analysis, we're joined on the phone from Capitol Hill in D.C., Jeff Young, healthcare reporter for The Hill newspaper. Jeff, how you doing?
Good. Good morning.
Good morning. Jeff, you heard the president. I heard him going down some of the key points of this bill that will, as the president said, make a difference in the lives of Americans. He seems to be trying really, really hard to remind voters what's in it for them, because this, the majority of the public now, the poll shows, the majority of the public is against this bill.
That seems to be the consensus of most of the opinion polling. I mean, the first thing the president has to do, it seems like, is snatch victory from the jaws of victory, so to speak. The House bill is pretty different, as you mentioned earlier, and a lot of folks in the president's liberal base are not happy with some of the concessions that happened in the Senate bill. But a big part of keeping the party united on this and convincing the left that all this was a good idea, I think, is selling the bill to the general public. The public gets behind it, then everything else kind of takes care of itself. And what we've been hearing the last few days from senators, people like Chuck Schumer, is, well, once people find out what's actually in this bill, they're going to change their minds about it. They're kind of banking a lot on that.
Do you think there's enough? We've asked this question already this morning. I want to get your take on it, Jeff Young from The Hill newspaper. Is there enough front-loaded benefit for people that will happen right away? Democrats seem to be vulnerable to the fact that there's an election in 2010 and none of the big policy changes take place until 2013 or 2014.
Well, yeah, and more than that, actually, if you the president's repeated promises of, if you like what you have, you can keep it, which, as you and I have talked about before, may not prove to be, strictly speaking, true.
Right.
But what is true is that if you're like most people who have insurance, you get it from your job, and that's not going to change except for a small fraction of people. So, in the first few years, in the last few years of, over the 10-year period that the bill's going to go into effect, you may not see any additional benefits at all. So that's why I think we've heard, and I'm surprised it took them this long to start saying this, we've heard the president and other Democrats bring up the Patient's Bill of Rights again and say, well, that's what this bill is, only more so.
An old battle from the 90s, the Patient Bill of Rights that involved John McCain and some other senators. Hey, Jeff, before we let you go, I want to ask you real quick. The president gave his speech and he's out the door. He's wheels up for Hawaii for vacation in just a few minutes. The president said earlier this week, I'm sticking around, to finish the job and make sure the Senate passes this bill. It kind of reminded me of when, during the campaign, when John McCain, suspended his campaign and came back to Washington to deal with the financial crisis. A little bit of political theater there, I think.
Probably, although he probably had to stick around just in case they really, really needed him to twist an arm or two.
Was there any danger ever that they wouldn't get the 51 vote majority to pass this bill?
No. I mean, the outcome today was preordained since 1 o'clock Monday morning when they had their first 60-vote on the floor, and all the Democrats voted together, and they voted together in everything since then all week.
Right. So now everyone around the Senate and probably more than one person at the White House setting up to get some sleep, and that includes reporters.
Yeah.
Jeff, you deserve a little bit of rest. I know that. Jeff Young from The Hill newspaper has been covering the healthcare debate from the start, and he's covering it now on Christmas Eve. Jeff Young, thanks for joining us. The president has just spoken live from the White House.
If you've missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. Take our podcast. You can subscribe at iTunes or at thetakeaway.org. We've been remixing holiday music all week. Here's another take from a listener.
This is Judy Baystor in Philo, California. Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree. You're dying in the corner. Oh, Christmas.
Christmas tree, oh Christmas tree, for you I am a mourner.
All right, we started out sentimental in this week, and now you guys are just getting a little silly.
Some of these are morbid. We had elves boiling, and now we have...
We take them all, though. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
You're dying in the corner.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
It's been a long, hard journey, but today is the day.
We'll never cast a more important vote in our careers.
We have made that first, most important step to make it a right rather than a privilege.
We stand on the doorstep of history. We recognize that.
I am never completely satisfied, but I am very satisfied.
The penultimate, nearly final vote on health care in the Senate, certainly historic, but also not the last.
This is DJ calling from New Jersey. Please, listeners, regarding the health care bill, don't expect perfection. That will never, never happen. Everyone has to compromise.
For you are mine at last.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, December 24th, Christmas Eve. I'm here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. And you heard the listener say that this is a compromise, which is absolutely true. And, you know, they say compromise means no one's really happy.
That's sort of the definition, because there are a lot of people in Washington who aren't happy, but the Senate leadership and the president are. So I guess this morning, maybe they're the most important. Well, good morning, Celeste. Let's get right to the top stories this morning and historic vote this morning in the Senate.
The yeas are 60, the nays are 39, H.R. 3590 as amended, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act is passed.
It's Vice President Joe Biden from his chair in the Senate announcing the passing of the health care reform bill this morning. Speaking moments ago, the president praised this what he said was a landmark measure.
As I've said before, these are not small reforms, these are big reforms. If passed, this will be the most important piece of social legislation since the Social Security Act passed in the 1930s, and the most important reform of our health care system since Medicare passed in the 1960s.
Majority Leader Harry Reid, who pulled together the 60 votes needed to beat back a Republican filibuster once again, got 60 votes today.
This is a victory for the American people. Those fortunate enough to have health insurance will be able to keep theirs, and those who do not will be able to have health insurance.
There's still one more round of negotiations with the House before this bill can become law.
For a look at that process, we're joined now by Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review and a blogger at CJR.org. Good morning, Trudy.
Good morning.
So we heard that the president lauding many of the reforms that are in this bill, and I wanted to do a quick smell test on it. He did say that this is going to not please the insurance companies. Is this effective restrictions and regulations on insurance company practices?
Well, I've been covering insurance for most of my career, and I have seen the attempts to regulate the insurance industry, and I've also seen ways that the insurance industry has gotten around the regulation. So I think that the jury is out. I think we have to wait and see what will happen. For example, we do know that they're not going to be able to refuse coverage for sick people anymore. However, there is some bad news with that. They still will be able to charge people who are sick, or people who are older, I should say, and perhaps likely to be sick, a lot more than somebody who's young. And the exact amount will probably be determined in the conference. In the Senate bill, I believe it's they can charge three times as much. In the House bill, twice as much.
Okay. Trudy, stay with us. We're going to be back with you in just a moment. Looking at the markets, Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway this hour at 10,466. The S&P opens at 1,120. The NASDAQ at 2,269.
Coming up, the Senate may have passed its version of the health reform bill, but there's still a lot of work left to do before the president can sign the bill into law. We're going to talk to some health care reporters about how upcoming Senate and House negotiations will further shape the bill. That's coming up in just a few minutes.
We can't doom another generation of Americans to soaring costs and eroding coverage and exploding deficits. Instead, we need to do what we were sent here to do and improve the lives of the people we serve. For the sake of our citizens, our economy, and our future, let's make 2010 the year we finally reform health care in the United States of America.
That's President Obama speaking just moments ago, standing in the stateroom of the White House before he heads off on his trip for the holidays to his home state of Hawaii. President Obama spoke not long ago, not long after the Senate passed the $871 billion bill by a 60-39 vote on party lines. Obama welcomed the vote as bringing America toward what he called the end of a nearly century-long struggle that began with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912, and seven presidents, as he said, both Republicans and Democrats, have tried to overhaul Medicare. Now all that's left to do, is combine the Senate version with the House version before that goes to the president's desk for his signature. That's not an easy task by a long shot. We're joined now by Carrie Budoff-Brown, health reporter for Politico, and Trudy Lieberman joins us again, a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and she blogs about health care for them. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Hi there.
Carrie, you may have heard me speaking with Trudy earlier about doing a little bit of a fact check here on what Obama said about this legislation. What do you think? Trudy said the jury is out on whether or not this is actually real restrictions or regulations on insurance company practices. Do you think this is a real change?
Sure. I mean, I think Trudy makes a good point. We don't yet know how the insurance industry is going to respond to this. I mean, the Congress will set out the law, but the industry, as you know, some on the left have feared, could possibly find loopholes or ways around what Congress sets out to do. So, I think this is the story. Once this bill, if it is signed into law, I don't think that the story does not end there. And there's going to be years of stories about, how the insurance industry responds to this, and whether what Congress set out to do will actually happen. And I'm not quite sure. None of us know how that's going to play out at this point.
That's kind of typical, though, for legislation. And
sure.
To a certain extent, anytime you're using regulations, it's a little bit of a whack-a-mole game, right?
Sure. I mean, yes. And I think there were a lot of predictions about the Medicare prescription drug expansion in 2003. The predictions about how that would work out. And I think most people think that one's worked out pretty well, after some initial glitches. So I think, we're going to see several stages of how the history on this bill is written, whether it's good or bad.
Okay, Trudy Lieberman, let's talk a little bit about the two small items that stand between the Senate version and the House version. And let's take the public option first. We've talked to you about this before. There are some congressmen who absolutely said, we will not vote for any legislation that does not include a public option. But in most cases, when it comes to reconciliation, the Senate wins out.
That seems to have been the history of this kind of legislation over the last several years. We certainly saw that during the S-CHIP debate in 2007 into 2008. What we're going to have to wait and see is whether all of those liberal congressmen in the House who said they supported a public plan, a robust public plan, will end up withholding their vote. Remember, the vote in the House was fairly close.
Yeah.
So they could very well tip the balance against this if they decide to fall on their sword for this. I think a lot of people don't expect that to happen. There's been a lot of chatter on the Internet, and I've been seeing a lot of stories that are being written by bloggers and others who are really very mightily disappointed by what's happened with the public plan option. And I think that those folks will be putting pressure on members of Congress to not support the Senate version. But I think in the end, the Senate bill could prevail and there will not be a public option. The insurance industry has not wanted it, and they've made no secret of that. But also the doctors haven't wanted it. Also the hospitals haven't wanted it. And the media has really not talked too much about their opposition to this. The opposition's always come from the insurers. So I think when you weigh what the stakeholders want and are willing to fall on their sword for it, as they've indicated, I think there probably will not be a public option in the final bill.
Okay, Carrie Budoff-Brown from Politico. Let's talk about the other most significant sticking point, and that's how we pay for this bill. The House version, of course, was a little over $1 trillion. The Senate version is $871 billion. So who do you think is going to win out here? The Senate version includes this. They both include a tax on so-called Cadillac insurance plans. The House is much lower. Who's going to win?
Actually, the House doesn't include a cap on
A surtax, yeah.
Yeah, it has a surtax on the wealthy. That's an income
right.
tax. So that is the major difference between the House and the Senate. So the White House has already said that they support this tax on Cadillac plans. That is what they push for. They think it's a way to start reducing the sort of excess spending on health care. When you have these expensive plans, it encourages a lot of spending, they say. So I think we're going to see the White House side with the Senate on this, and that's going to upset the House because the House has been very resistant to this idea of capping the amount or taxing insurers that offer these high-income plans because they say that they disproportionately affect, you know, union workers who have fought for years for better health care plans in lieu of wages. But it seems like the White House is going to weigh in on behalf of the Senate on this one. The Senate will win. I think the millionaire's tax, which is what is in the House bill, the income tax on the wealthy, that is not acceptable in the Senate. I think you would see Ben Nelson leaving the deal if that returned in any form. So you're likely to see a financing package that more closely mirrors the Senate.
Okay, the bill, if it works as it stands now, does do a few things that were promised by candidate Obama. It extends coverage to 30 million Americans who right now are uninsured. And again, as we said earlier, it does impose some restrictions. Listen to this that Obama said just a few minutes ago.
Insurance companies will no longer be able to deny you coverage on the basis of a pre-existing condition. They will no longer be able to drop your coverage when you get sick. No longer will you have to pay unlimited amounts out of your own pocket for the treatments you need. And you'll be able to appeal unfair decisions by insurance companies to an independent party.
Trudy Lieberman, last question for you. Besides covering the uninsured, that may be the most popular piece of this legislation once it gets out to the public.
You mean for the uninsured?
Well, in other words, the pre-existing conditions, being able to appeal if you've had your coverage dropped.
Yeah, I think that was a very egregious practice, and it resonated very much with the population. But people have to remember that in the individual market, that was an issue. It is not an issue in the employer market where most people get their coverage. People who have pre-existing conditions in large employer groups and in smaller employer groups get coverage. So it will make a difference only to those people, the uninsured, who have to go into the open market or to the exchange and buy coverage. And as I said earlier, there are caveats that go with that because the insurance companies are not able to accept those kinds of risks and still
right.
stay in business.
Okay, Trudy Lieberman, contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Also, Carrie Budoff-Brown, health reporter for Politico. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at the headlines.
The latest jobless numbers are in. The Labor Department reported that some 28,000 people filed unemployment claims last week. AP says the labor market may be stabilizing. And don't miss this one with all the health care news. The Senate also voted this morning to raise the amount of debt the government can carry to $12.4 trillion.
A blizzard warning has been expanded this morning to include northwestern Nebraska, along with Kansas, western North Dakota, and northern Minnesota. Icy roads, along with canceled and delayed flights, are creating some travel problems. And Santa's on his way. You can follow Santa via email, Twitter, or Facebook. This happens every year. The military's North American Air Command lets kids follow Santa's journey by going onto the website for NORAD. You can look up and check how he's getting along the coast. As you've been talking about all morning, an exciting day in Washington, the Senate has passed its version of the health care overhaul bill 60-39. And the bill will have to be reconciled with a House bill. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said the fight will continue. Republicans will continue to fight this health care reform bill. We're going to be following this story as we continue throughout the hour. The Senate bill, however, has passed 60-39, as I said, and the senators are heading home, wherever that may be, for a much-earned rest.
Hey, you want that to go?
Some takeouts now on the stories we're following this Christmas week. First, a technology takeout. Massive email service outage Tuesday, left BlackBerry users out of luck for more than 9 hours. It's the second drop of the week, and it sparked chatter of cell phone mutiny and BlackBerry mutiny. Nick Bilton is back with us. He's lead writer for the Bits blog in the technology section of the New York Times. Nick, I am one of these disgruntled BlackBerry users. It was infuriating at first, and then after about 3 hours, liberating. Nobody from the show could reach me. I ate lunch.
Yeah, it was. I'm sure that certain people felt that way, but there was a lot of people that were pretty upset about what happened.
Do we have news of anybody who lost a deal or lost millions because they didn't get their email for 7 hours? I was envisioning that this could have really been a problem.
There was a lot of chatter on Twitter of some bank executives that were pretty upset. I think they're very reliant on their BlackBerries. And then there was also some discussions and some news coverage about people in Hollywood and producers and things like that.
And the actual cause of the outage, is there a way to explain it without blazing
over? It was
over?
This very strange thing called human error.
Heard of that.
Yes. So what happened was the BlackBerry technicians were trying to update the messenger service on the BlackBerry, and in turn they ended up pushing the whole system down for about 9 hours.
So now BlackBerry has a major service quality problem.
Well, the problem is that it's such a huge infrastructure that they when they do these fixes, it's as one computer scientist says, it's like changing the wheels on a car as it's going 60 miles an hour, and they went through the problem of trying to do that.
And the wheels came off.
And the wheels came off, exactly.
Nick Bilton from the New York Times Bits blog, thanks.
Thank you.
Everybody can recognize this song, right?
On the first day of Christmas, my true love gave to me a partridge in a pear tree.
Forget how much all that stuff cost when this song was written in the 1800s or so. Since 1984, there's been people who've been tracking how much it costs every single year. We have Louise Story, the New York Times finance reporter, here to tell us about how much it would cost to give these 12 days of Christmas gifts this year.
Good morning. So it would cost $21,465.56 to give the 12 days of Christmas, which secretly I've always kind of wanted.
Really?
Yeah.
What would you do with
Wouldn't that be very romantic if the
singing
mate...
What would you do with the French hens?
You know, I could use the 5 golden rings. Now, speaking of
five
the golden
rings... But milkmaids? Where are you going to put the milkmaids?
Is there a price point for them?
Well, I'm figuring they show up and
I don't have room
leave.
In my apartment for lords dancing.
That would be a problem. But you know what's interesting about this is that it's actually a good way to track what's happening with inflation. So what PNC does, they're the ones who have tracked this, is they look at the prices every year. Over last year, it's up 1.8%. And when you compare that to inflation year over year in November was up 1.7%.
Oh, that's pretty accurate.
So you can pull out parts. You know, the golden rings are up. The prices of gold have been up a lot. Energy prices are up.
Yeah.
Wages are down, except for some of these. The dancers, apparently, dancers' wages have gone up.
Wow, but the milkmaid's down. You can take a look at these this price index on our website, thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Louise.
My true love gave to me 8 maids a-milking, 7 swans a-swimming, 6 geese a-laying, 5 golden rings.
I still say there's no price point for lords dancing, but Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here because he has sports gifts that he has in mind. He's Takeaway sports contributor. Ibrahim, you have Christmas holiday sports gifts.
So the idea behind this is that Sasha and Malia, the in the first family, wanted to give a sports gift for President Obama. So I thought that these could be some potential good ones. First off was the Yankees DVD of the 2009 World Series.
he's a Sox fan.
Yankees memorabilia was in high demand this year, especially the old stadium seats from the old Yankee Stadium. Those are going like hotcakes. They're actually the highest selling items on eBay this year is Yankees memorabilia. Also, the Martin Brodeur, who's breaking records in hockey.
NHL hockey.
Hockey. He's breaking records with appearances and in shutouts. So a signed puck by Martin Brodeur would be
I
a
would
great
get that.
Gift.
Yeah.
And then finally, Tiger Woods' Wii game. You can practice your swing with Tiger Woods' Wii game.
I'd rather practice Elin's swing. She's got a pretty good one.
All All right, those are three gift ideas from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And now we do have to talk about one of sports bad boys. You've been talking about your top sports stories of 2009. We got to talk about a sports bad boy, and of course he has his own tag now.
Barbaric. Let that word resound from hill to hill and from mountain to mountain.
Of course, Senator Robert Byrd, barbaric. Who's he talking about?
He's talking about Michael Vick. Michael Vick was a disgraced former Atlanta Falcons quarterback. He was at one time the highest paid football player in the NFL, and he was an electrifying, fast quarterback. Now he's the current Philadelphia Eagles quarterback, and he did almost 2 years for operating a dogfighting ring. There was concern when he got out that no team would want him. So we spent a lot of time this year wondering, who's going to want Vic? Where is he going to go? Who's going to want Vic? Where is he going to go? Now you could say that Michael Vick is on his way to football redemption. He's with the Philadelphia Eagles. They're on a hot streak, and they could be one of the teams that's a sleeper to win the Super Bowl.
What would happen if Michael Vick, after all the disgrace, became a Super Bowl champion?
It would be an excellent, excellent Saturday, you know, morning special movie type of thing.
It would keep Ibrahim working for a long time.
it would do that. And you've been one of his, I want to say, sort of one of his supporters through all this.
I think that you do your time, the time that you've been allotted. He's been remorseful throughout that whole process. And him coming back would be excellent, I think, for football and for him as well. And for people that have done things and been able to bounce back from them, that's what it's about. It's about the ability to bounce back. That's the Michael Vick story.
Well, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, for those of us who are Senate watchers, that tape of Senator Robert Byrd, the longest-serving member of Congress, calling Michael Vick barbaric, was a gift to us. And it'll be golden every single time
Indeed.
We talk about Michael Vick from here to eternity. I promise you that. As we're talking about the Senate has just passed President Obama's health overhaul, extending medical insurance to more
they're
than 30,
going home.
30 million Americans. Well, they're heading for the jet planes. They've got what's called jet fume fever. They cast that vote, and they're headed home. No doubt about it. Well, having more doctors, speaking of the healthcare debate, having more doctors sounds like a great idea to long waits and not being able to get enough tests or a doctor's appointment. But is it the best thing for the healthcare system? Is it the best thing for costs? We're going to be talking about that very issue in just a few minutes. Coming up, having more doctors sounds like a great idea and a great solution to those long waits you have to go through in order to get a simple doctor's appointment. But in a few minutes, we're going to talk to some healthcare specialists who say that simply adding more doctors might actually do more harm to the health system than good. Right now, let's check on some news stories at 31 minutes past the hour. New economic numbers out in the last hour show the number of new jobless claims has fallen more than expected. The Labor Department says the new number is now around 452,000, down nearly 30,000 from last week. That's the lowest level in job loss since September of last year. In Iraq, we're getting word of a suicide bomber attack in Baghdad. Officials say there are at least 9 dead and more than 30 injured.
Let's see how the morning news is affecting the Wall Street. The Dow is now up by 6. The S&P is up 1 and the NASDAQ up by 4. So it looks like Wall Street likes health care reform bills. More on the top story. President Obama speaking in the past hour.
In a historic vote that took place this morning, members of the Senate joined their colleagues in the House of Representatives to pass a landmark health insurance reform package, legislation that brings us toward the end of a nearly century-long struggle to reform America's health care system.
So what's next?
Having passed reform bills in both the House and the Senate, we now have to take up the last and most important step and reach an agreement on a final reform bill that I can sign into law.
Speaking earlier, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Republicans will continue to fight the law.
I want to assure you, Mr. President, this fight isn't over. In fact, this fight is long from over.
Not a single Republican voted for the bill.
Not only did not a single Republican vote for it, but that final health care legislation in the Senate was shaped by the threat of a filibuster, as many bills these days are. Julian Zelitzer is a congressional historian and author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism. He joins us now. We're also joined by Alan Simpson, former senator from Wyoming. He was the Senate Republican whip from 1985 to 1995. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
You bet.
Julian, let me start with you. The most famous filibuster stories go back to trying to pass the Civil Rights Act. Most people don't know that the House was passing civil rights legislation since the 30s, and it wasn't until the late 50s that it finally passed the Senate because of the filibuster.
That's true. The filibuster was a great enemy of civil rights proponents in the 1940s and 1950s. As the bills finally got out of the House, the Southern caucus in the Senate was able to use this rule. At the time, it required 67 votes to end a filibuster to block any progress until both 1957 and then 64 when legislation passed. But the NAACP regularly listed filibuster reform as important as ending lynching or ending public segregation. But
Julian, help me out here. The majority always wants filibuster reform, right? Because they see the minority holding up all their bills.
Absolutely. I mean, the majority is often frustrated with the way that the Senate works, and you see the parties kind of flip back and forth on these positions, and I think that often makes this reform harder to achieve. I mean, you could look at the newspaper in 2004 and 2005 and find all kinds of speeches by Democrats defending the filibuster, the same ones who today are calling for some kind of reform.
Senator Simpson, why filibusters so much more common now than they were 50 years ago? I mean, even routine legislation now requires 60 votes with the attendant delaying tactics. Why so much more common now?
Well, I think just because of the numbers. When you get near 60, I mean, you're near the magic. You're into the magic kingdom. And I think that's why it is. But Julian is quite correct. It was the Western and Southern senators that resisted the civil rights bill on the basis of an intrusion into personal rights, business endeavors, and so on. But the filibuster is like a giant wheel, like a Rube Goldberg wheel with boots on it, and it'll kick you in the fanny one time, and then as it rotates, it'll kick the other guy in the fanny. And it is a great protector. It's frustrating. It drove us crazy when I was the assistant to Bob Dole for 10 years. But let me tell you, I doubt that they'll ever get rid of it. But remember, there's always a centrist group. There was that 7 and 7 group, 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats.
That's that gang of 14.
Destroyed the nuclear option. You don't want to ever get to that, but there are centrists, and they'll surface again in the health care bill when this baby comes back from conference. It'll look like the tar baby.
Now, that 7 and 7 you're talking about, Senator Simpson, was around the issue of filibustering judicial nominations, but you piqued my interest. Give me one example, if you would, from when you were Republican whip of when the use of the filibuster kicked your fanny.
Well, it just happens. You're in the majority one session, and then you're in the minority the next. And so you just put the boot on a different foot, and you say, now, we need you guys to hold tough. And the purpose of it is cloture, which is to cut off debate. And you have to have the horses to do that. And if you don't, you don't cut off debate. But it does. I know it's frustrating. It just drove us crazy. But nevertheless, it can be the best thing in your arsenal of legislation, or it can be the worst on the other side, and that's the way it works.
It drove you crazy, but you also successfully drove your colleagues crazy when you filibustered during the debate over campaign finance reform. And I'm wondering, Julian, you know, Robert Byrd very famously filibustered for 14 hours during the debate over civil rights. Julian, as Todd was saying, when people are in the majority, they don't like filibustering. When they're in the minority, they don't. But filibustering isn't necessarily a bad thing. There have been times when it's been used to good effect.
Well, look, obviously there are some who defend the filibuster on both sides of the aisle. During the 1930s, Huey Long would use this to filibuster bills that he thought were favorable to the wealthy rather than to the poor. I think the question that gets raised with the current situation is that the filibuster is now used too much, meaning we now have an expectation that every bill in the Senate requires 60 votes. It's become the norm when that's not in the rules of the Senate. And, you know, for much of the 40s and 50s, much of the legislation still passed through a simple majority. And I think that's what you're hearing in terms of reform can we get this so we don't eliminate the filibuster, but that that's not how the Senate operates all the time. Filibusters have increased in frequency since the 1960s, and they're used much more regularly.
So, Julian, you'd pare them back instead of, it used to be 67 until 1975, now it's 60 votes, you'd pare it back to maybe 55 in the spirit, you know, the whole point of 60 votes is you have to form some level of consensus. The in this case, the Democrats, the majority, can't just roll over the minority.
I don't have a number in mind, and I'm just talking about the reformers, but one idea, yeah, lower the number needed to end the filibuster. Another could be more change in norms, that there's some kind of agreement not to use this all the time and to save it for more extraordinary moments.
Senator Simpson, 55 votes for a filibuster. Quickly, what do you think?
No, I don't think it'll ever go to that because you have power in one person. Look at Sanders and Lieberman and Nelson. They're playing big dog, and they've got the horses, but filibuster is the savior and demon all rolled into one glorious legislative protective shield.
Former Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming and congressional historian Julian Zelitzer, thank you both for joining us. Of course, the Senate just passed this version of the health care bill, and one senator didn't vote at all. That's Republican Jim Bunning of Kentucky. We want to catch up with John Stanton of Roll Call, Senate reporter. He's found out why, or at least gotten a statement from the Bunning camp. John, why didn't the senator vote?
Well, according to his spokesman, the senator had, quote, family commitments to attend to.
Family commitments. Sounds reasonable.
Well, it would sound very reasonable, of course, except for when one considers the fact that all 100 senators and all the personal staff and the support staff in the Congress, not to mention all the reporters, also had family matters to attend to on Christmas Eve.
Right. All right, John Stanton of Roll Call. You don't sound bitter at all there, buddy. I know you had family commitments as well, but we should point out Senator Jim Bunning retiring this year, not running for re-election, probably didn't feel a whole lot of pressure to be on the Senate floor to cast a vote on a bill that he strongly opposes. John Stanton, thanks for joining us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwellick.
And I'm Celeste Headley. California is falling deeper and deeper into debt. The state has a deficit in excess of $20 billion. And Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger is asking the federal government for about $8 billion to stay afloat. He's threatened to cut. Well, he says they have to cut, if not eliminate, the main welfare program in the state and care services for the elderly and disabled if they don't get some help. Dan Walter is a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. Good morning, Dan. How serious is this threat?
Oh, it's hard to say how serious it is. Arnie has a tendency to kind of fire for effect and worry about the details later. I think he's, more than anything, he's just trying to dramatize that California is in deep fiscal tapioca and needs to find a way out. And indeed we are, but we've been there for like 9 years. I mean, it's like nothing new. But it seems to get worse every year. Our deficit definitely predates the current recession. It's more structural than that.
But $20 billion is new, that you guys have reached an all-time high.
No, it's been higher. It's been considerably higher, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
$20 billion may be actually fairly conservative. It may well go beyond that if the economy in California doesn't start picking up soon. So, no, actually, compared to some of the deficits they faced in recent years, it's fairly small at this moment, but it's probably going to get bigger.
What can be done? I mean, even if they get $8 billion from the federal government, is that even enough to stem the bleeding?
No, it isn't. The projection is that the current year's budget's out of whack by about $6 or $6.5 billion, and the next year's budget's out of whack by 14 or so. And then the legislature's budget office says the state has $20 billion per year deficits in the works for ad infinitum. I mean, this is just a one-time thing. This is something that's been going on for a number of years, and it will probably continue for a number of years. And the governor, in fact, it cost the last governor his job. You might recall there was a recall in 2003 because of the
I do happen to recall that.
Couldn't handle a problem. Yeah.
The question for me is at this point, if politicians don't necessarily like to talk about cutting programs for the elderly and the disabled, but it sounds like some pretty basic services in the state are going to have to be cut if they're going to grapple with this deficit at all.
Well, that's probably true. There's only about four big areas where the state spends money. K-12 education, that's about 40% of the budget. Prisons is about 10%. Health and welfare programs, another 20 or 30%. And then you have interest on the debts. They've already run up. It's not rocket science. They know where they are. They've got about $105 to $10 billion a year baseline budget. That's everything that they should be doing under the law, and about $80, $85 billion in baseline revenues. I mean, it's not really rocket science. This is a continuous problem that California's had, and mostly it's been papered over with bookkeeping gimmicks and deferrals. For example, even this year, they're not going to cut the checks for state employees for the June payroll until July, so it counts in the next fiscal year. You know, tricks like that, sort of stuff that people went to jail for in the Enron scandal.
Yeah, it sounds like those paper tricks can only work for so long. Dan Walters is a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee. He's talking about California, where the deficit is in excess of $20 billion. The governor has said they may have to cut the state's main welfare program, along with services for the elderly and disabled. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillig. And Todd, you spend a lot of time in Washington. What's the typical hobby for a congressman?
Typical hobby?
Yeah, golf maybe.
Golf. Yeah, I would say probably golf is a big one.
Well, Senator Orrin Hatch, his hobby is writing songs, and in fact is a really successful songwriter. He has gold and platinum albums to his credit. And although he's a Mormon from Utah, he has written a new Hanukkah song. We're going to talk to him about remixing his favorite holiday music in just a few minutes. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. As we've been talking about all morning long, an exciting day in Washington with the Senate passing its version of the health care reform bill. Here's some of President Obama's reaction.
We are now finally poised to deliver on the promise of real, meaningful health insurance reform that will bring additional security and stability to the American people.
Many senators are off on their holidays now, but before they left, they gave various reactions. Speaking in the past hour, here's Democratic Senator from Illinois, Dick Durbin.
It's also a candle of hope for this nation that we are finally tackling an issue which every family, every business knows is central to our progress as a nation.
Of course, the bill still needs to be reconciled with the House version. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says the fight over health care reform is far from over.
With all the news on health care, you might have missed this one. The Senate also voted to raise the amount of debt the government can carry to $12.4 trillion. Now, we're just hearing now the New Jersey man and his 9-year-old son have left Brazil at the end of a 5-year international custody battle. David Goldman and his son Sean are on their way back to the U.S. That just out now. We're also hearing that at least 9 people have been killed and more than 30 injured in a suicide bombing in Baghdad. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, the festival of light. In Jerusalem, the oil burned bright. They lit the menorah in that holy place. What a miracle to last 8 days.
Well, the Hanukkah is over, but we're still remixing the holidays here at The Takeaway. And if you've heard that song earlier this month, you may not have known that the man behind the lyrics isn't just a songwriter. He has a day job, and that's in the Senate. It's Republican Senator Orrin Hatch. He happens to be Mormon, but he's written a lot of Christmas music, but this is his first Hanukkah song. We had to invite him to join us when we were talking about remixing the holidays. He was a little busy today, so we did this last week. I asked him, Senator Orrin Hatch, how serious his songwriting hobby is and whether it takes up a lot of his free time.
Well, it really doesn't. I don't sleep well. I'm on planes all the time, so, you know, I write on planes. I write at night. I wake up in the middle of the night and write, and sometimes... I even one time mentioned that I wrote a song during a boring committee meeting, and I got this irate letter saying, "How dare you use taxpayer time to write your lousy music?" So I don't tell that story anymore.
But do you still write songs during boring committee meetings?
Not too much anymore.
You can admit it. I won't tell anyone. You actually won a gold and a platinum record for this song. God heals us when we're broken. That's Unspoken, which was recorded by Jackie Velasquez. She's a Christian rock star. And this time you decided to write something for the Jewish faithful. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, Jeff Goldberg, who writes for the Atlantic Monthly, came to me in 1999. And we were chatting about a lot of things in the office. Then he said he wanted to hear some of my music, so I played some. He said, "Why don't you write a Hanukkah song?" He said, "We don't have a great Hanukkah song. All we have is Adam Sandler." and that is a hilarious song. Well, I said I would do it. And I kept that in my mind for really about 10 years. And then finally last year, about this time, Jeff wrote a blog and said, "I wish Senator Hatch would write that Hanukkah song." So I did.
He called you out.
Yeah, he did. I sat down and I wrote the lyrics, and then I called Madeline Stone. Madeline and I have written a lot of music together. She's a wonderful Jewish woman in New York City and in Nashville, has a lot of gold and platinum records herself, and really one of the best writers in America. She decided to do it with me, and that's how it came about.
And Madeline Stone is actually in our studios together. Madeline, he said there's no great Hanukkah songs, but come on, what about "Dreidel, Dreidel, Dreidel, I made you out of clay"?
It's a great one.
So you've worked with the senator on other things.
Yes, we wrote the Unspoken song
together
that you just heard. Yes, and we've written love songs and all kinds of music, and I love writing with him. He's great.
Senator, I want to play some other Christmas music that you've written. Here's one of your releases.
When I say Merry Christmas in a song, will you join heart to heart and sing along?
Now, that sounds like something I'd hear if I were in Disneyland during Christmas time. And I'm wondering if when you write something that's actually in line with your own faith, does it mean something different from you, or are they all pretty much equally satisfactory for you?
Well, pretty much equally satisfactory. You know, we were writing a lot of the albums we've written really aren't necessarily religious. They're kind of like White Christmas. But this one we wanted to be religious on the Hanukkah song, because it really is a... It is a really good tribute to my friends in the Jewish community, and to Israel. I'm a strong supporter of Israel, and of course, even I support moderate Arabs who are for peace in the Middle East as well. But I'm just overwhelmed with how grateful a lot of my Jewish friends are. They just have gone out of their way to talk to me. Even some enemies who have been Jewish around here. Some enemies around here have come up and with big smiles on their face and said, "We love your song." So I feel real good about it.
Well, Madeline, Senator Madeline has shared with us what her favorite Christmas song is, and she really goes classic.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
That is the Velvet Fog, Mel Torme singing Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire. Senator, are you willing to share with us what your favorite holiday song is?
Well, that's really a pretty song. You know, I really like Handel's Messiah, probably the most...
Talk about going classic.
Well, I love classical music. In fact, I like music from all genres. It's just a lot of fun for me. Of course, as somebody who certainly doesn't have all the skills that Madeline has, you know, I don't know when I've been so proud of a song as I am this Hanukkah song, because it's meant so much to so many good people out there, and it means a lot to me, too. You know, it's no secret that I wear a mezuzah around my neck. I've done that for over 30 years, given to me by a wonderful rabbi years ago, and I do that to just constantly remind myself of my obligations towards Israel and the whole Middle East.
Well, it must have been nice for you, Senator, also since you've worked with Madeline Stone for so long, it must have been nice to write a song that is in line with her faith.
Yeah, it really was, because Madeline is really a super individual and a tremendous, tremendous talent with regard to writing music and composing music. I mean, she really is very good. You know, she's Jewish, but she won a Dove Award, which is the highest award you can get for Christian music. So I thought it was pretty good. And it was about time we did something for Madeline's faith. We've had a few snotty remarks on the blogs, but that's par for the course. Most of those
you're
are
nobody
just...
till you get snotty remarks on the blog, Senator.
That's right. And it's mainly against me, not against the song.
Well, you know, maybe your next one will be called "All I Want for Christmas is Healthcare Reform."
Well, you know, the problem is that if they'd listen to me, we'd have health care reform by now. You know, almost every major health care bill that works has my name on it. Hatch-Waxman, Hatch-Dodd, the orphan drug bill, the the chip bill. You could go right on down the line.
But it doesn't make for catchy lyrics, does it?
Yeah, sometimes it does. Every once, Ted Kennedy and I, you know, we fought each other most of the time, but we became very great friends. And he was very fond of whenever he knew he was in the doghouse with me, coming and singing one of my songs at me. I mean, he had a great sense of humor. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, great. The new song is called 8 Days of Hanukkah. That is Senator Orrin Hatch, the songwriter behind that song. And Madeline Stone also joined us. She was a songwriter. She's worked with the senator for 8 or 9 years. Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Happy Hanukkah.
Now, all this week, we've been remixing holiday music to give it a new spin, and we're asking our listeners, is there a holiday tune that you've just got to hear this time of year, or maybe you have a guilty pleasure song like this listener?
Hi, this is Desmond from Detroit. My guilty pleasure holiday song is Santa Claus Goes Straight to the Ghetto. And it kind of goes, Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto.
Santa Claus goes straight to the ghetto.
Tell him, James Brown sent you. Share your favorites with us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
If you missed anything, we're always here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast at iTunes or thetakeaway.org.
And here's your takeaway.
With passage of reform bills in both the House and the Senate, we are now finally poised to deliver on the promise of real, meaningful health insurance reform that will bring additional security and stability to the American people.
The president from the White House, the health care bill has passed 60 to 39. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway. Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI, to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.